On the Go Media proudly presents Between the Ropes with your hosts, Colt Powers and Hunter Dietz.
Welcome back to Between the Ropes. As usual, I'm Hunter Dietz. This is Colt Powers, and we've got a great guest for you here today. Now involved with the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame in Waterloo, a WWE Hall of Famer, the longest reigning champion in SmackDown history up until 2018. John Bradshaw Layfield, JBL, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I don't want to just kind of like par straws here, but, you know, AJ Styles beat my reign, but he beat it in two reigns, so the longest continuous reign. I got to hold on to as much as I can for as long as I can.
That's right.
Sure, we can't disagree with that. Absolutely. Now that you're involved with the Hall of Fame here in Waterloo, we're working with them, obviously. And we got to talk to Mr. Jerry Briscoe a couple weeks ago, Medusa last week, and now we're on to you. And tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the Hall of Fame.
Well, Jerry Briscoe, you know, my dear friend who I do a podcast with and have done so for many years. We started during COVID, but he's the one that hired me back in 1995 in WWE, and we've been really good friends ever since. He's a huge part of the Tragos Luthez Hall of Fame there in Waterloo, Iowa, and a big part of the success of that. And he wanted me to come in years ago, and I came in and just fell in love with it. I'm a huge historian. I love the Hall of Fame that they have there and all the stuff they have that is on display, the stuff they have that's not on display, which you can get a tour of and go down to the basement, which millions of people, not millions, hundreds if not a thousand people have done. And it's just a cool place. And I just love what they do there. It's so unique. It's one of the few physical Hall of Fames, but it's also the amateur and the professional wrestling together, which is the only one like that.
Yeah, well, and that's part of what makes it so special, and I think such a cool thing for us around here. Obviously, Dan Gable from this area, and we didn't get the opportunity to ask Mr. Briscoe, but we had the thought, maybe you have an opinion, if Dan Gable had gotten into pro wrestling, how do you think that would have turned out?
Same as, you know, guys like Danny Hodge or Jack Briscoe. I think he'd have been a terrific champion. I've been a terrific champion for a long time. You know, Coach Gable, Mr. Gable, is maybe the greatest amateur of all time. He's certainly in every conversation when you talk about the greatest amateur of all time, one of the greatest coaches of all time. He's just a stud. I mean, when he walks in a room, the room just changes. You know, it's something about him when he walks in. You know, it's kind of like guys like The Rock, you know, or Dan Gable. Those guys just have an aura about them. Got to meet Arnold years ago backstage when he's doing stuff with us. The same thing, same aura about him. I think he'd have been fantastic at pro wrestling. Would have loved to have him in the ring.
Yeah, and obviously the museum, the amateur side of it, a lot of that dedicated to him and very big in this area. But were you ever an amateur wrestler?
No, we didn't have it. You know, back when I was in Texas, we had two sports. We had football and spring football, and that was about it. We didn't even have baseball. I loved baseball. I love it to this day. I'd love to play baseball, but we didn't have it because they didn't want the young kids to play anything other than spring football. And so football was so big, we didn't have a lot of sports. Now, the school system didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, wrestling doesn't take a lot of money. But wrestling wasn't big back then in Texas. But the reason was because football was so big. Now they're starting to get it all over the place. I'd love to have been an amateur wrestler. I don't know if I'd have been any good at it, but I'd love to have tried. I trained with Brad Reingans up in Minnesota. He's the one that broke me. The same one that broke in Road Warriors, Brock Lesnar, and Vader, and so many guys. Brad was the 1980 Greco-Roman World Champion. And, it was so much fun training amateur style and shooting with Brad on the mat. I didn't do very well, but it was a lot of fun being out there the World Champion. I'd love to have given it a try.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure that was kind of a big thing for you. But Colt, did you have any questions as we're starting to kind of think about him getting into wrestling and his career? Did you have any questions about him kind of breaking into the business?
Well, yeah, so you had early days. You played football. How did you transition into pro wrestling?
I needed a job. That was pretty much it. I played, I had a decent college career. I was a couple time All-American. I was consensus All-American as a senior, but I had three knee surgeries. I had two broken legs. I just wasn't the same guy when I got out of college that I was, say, when I was a junior. I just wasn't the same athlete. And maybe it was that, or maybe it was just an overall lack of ability. For whatever reason, I didn't hang around professional football that long. I was hoping, to play, 7-8 years, was my goal. And that didn't work out. And like I say, it was either injuries or lack of ability, one of the two. And I coached a year at Athens Junior College, where John Randall went. I played against Randall in college. We both played Division II. And he set every sack record that I don't think's ever been broken. But he went to school there at that little junior college in Athens. I coached there and had a blast. But I made pretty much below poverty level. And I thought I need to, if I want to try wrestling, because I was always a wrestling fan. And I thought, if I'm going to try this, I need to go ahead and do it now. I mean, I could have tried to hang around pro football a little bit longer, but I was going to be one of those guys that was always on the bubble, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to give a shot at pro wrestling. So I'd fortunately had met a guy playing in the World League, Randy Thornton, who was an amateur wrestler out of Minnesota, who wrestled some in Japan. He had trained with Brad Rangins. And, back then, you couldn't get hold of guys, and Brad didn't train a lot of people. And it was so important who you got trained by, whether it was like Hiro Matsuda, Carl Gotch, or Billy Robinson, or Brad Rangins. But it was, it was really hard to get in with those guys. But because I'd known Randy, Randy gave me the in and called Brad and moved up to Minnesota. And literally, as soon as I got cut in my third year, I started training within a month or two to go into pro wrestling.
Okay, so you moved up to Minnesota to train up there. And so your early days, in Minnesota was where you kind of cut your teeth, or did you end up moving around a lot, or?
No, I didn't. I would love to, but the territory pretty much died there. Vern Gagne had already, the territory was still some people running. Eddie Sharkey was running a little bit up there. There was Vern's territory was kind of in shambles at the time. He'd already kind of retired from it, so people were kind of trying to keep it alive, but it was on life support. So I came back down to Texas, which was starting to get hot again, and I went to Sportatorium on a Friday afternoon with my bag and showed up, and I think it's a good story. I always love when people would tell Vince McMahon, "I've got a great idea for you." Vince would always say, "I'll be the judge of that." So I hate when people say, "I got a great story you're going to love." I don't know if you're going to love it or not. You may think it sucks. But I show up at the Sportatorium on a Friday afternoon, got my bag with me, and James Beard answers the door, the legendary referee that's in the Von Erich movie and was part of the great Texas tradition there. And he said, "Can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, I want a job." And he goes, "Well," he goes, "Well, are you a wrestler?" I go, "I don't know if I'm a wrestler or not, but I've been trained." And he said, "Well, who trained you?" I said, "Brad Rangins." I mean, this just happens in the middle of the afternoon in the Sportatorium. And he said, "Brad Rangins trained you?" And he goes, "What did you do before that?" I said, "I played a little pro football." So they bring me in there, and there's Akbar and the guys, and they said, "This guy played pro football. Brad Rangins trained him." I didn't even know how to work. I mean, I'd just been trained. I had no matches. Lou Perez, who was Al Perez's working cousin, had no-showed that day because of travel. He didn't no-show. Travel had a problem or something. He didn't make it. They needed somebody in the main event. So they'd say, "Well, let's just put this kid in there." And so my first match is in the main event at the Sportatorium against Rod Price, the champion. And they told Rod, said, "If he can wrestle, go 20 minutes. If he can't, go home at 2. And Rod was a great wrestler. He was the right guy, a terrific worker. And he carried me for about 20 minutes. And so that's how I got my start. Was I started on top in the main event at the Sportatorium. I come back, and I think it was that night or shortly thereafter, I see Kendall Nagasaki, Mr. Sakurada, and he says, he asked who I was. And he goes, "Oh, he's a big kid trained by Brad Rankins." Well, that was almost impossible to get done back then. And he goes, "Really? He got trained by Brad?" And he goes, "Yeah, he played a little pro football." So now all of a sudden he thinks I'm like the second big, the next big thing, He doesn't know I can't work. He didn't watch my match. He just knew I was in the main event. So he thought, "Man, this kid must have been working a few years. He's a prodigy or something." Never heard of him. He says, "You come Japan?" I go, "Sure." I'm in Japan in a couple months, tagging with Bob Orton Jr.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wow. And Bob Orton Jr., what a legend. Also a Hall of Famer. He's kind of an underrated talent when you talk about people today. People throw out the big names like a Hulk Hogan or an Andre the Giant. But Bob Orton, especially around that like early WrestleMania time, you were obviously a fan of wrestling during that time. Bob Orton's like one of the top heels, right?
Absolutely. And his dad, Randy's granddad, was one of the best heels of all time, Bob O, in the 70s. But Bob Orton Jr., my God, that guy was awesome. I mean, absolutely awesome. Terrific heel, terrific bad guy, could work. I mean, he just had a knowledge, a real tough guy, too. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. We were in Japan, our first trip there. He's got that gravelly voice, and we're driving to some island. I think it was Shikoku. I'm not sure. It's one of the other – there's four main islands, one of the islands, I believe. I think it was the easterly island. And he says, well, see you in a couple of days, kid. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I can't go to that island. And I said, what do you mean you can't go to the island? He goes, I had a mafia hit put on me. So years before, Bob had a few drinks. Somebody got smarted off to him, and Bob slaps him. And apparently it was the wrong guy, and the mafia said they were going to kill him if he ever came back to the island. So we literally would leave Bob at like this Japanese bed and breakfast, go to the island and wrestle and pick him up in a couple days and go somewhere else because Bob had this mafia hit put on him. Oh, I mean, I couldn't even imagine how boring it must have been for Bob all by himself. There was no English television, nothing to read, nothing to do, just sitting there at some bed and breakfast in the middle of nowhere.
Wow. That's kind of crazy. We were talking to Medusa about some of her time in Japan last week, and she was talking about how the biggest culture shock for her was coming back to America from Japan because the cultures are just so different. Did you find it different working in Japan significantly from when you were working in America?
I loved it. I loved the Japanese people. I didn't like the food, unfortunately. I wish I did. I just wasn't a big fan of the food, unfortunately. So it was tough back then to find American food places. You know, so I didn't like that part of it. But and there was no English television. But back in the day, you know, we're just having fun going out and seeing stuff. We didn't care. But I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the culture. I loved the people. I loved the wrestling. The style was really. I loved it. Territories were all different. So Japanese territory was completely different from Texas territory, completely different from Puerto Rico, completely different from Europe, from Tennessee, from Florida, from Minnesota. It was a real serious style, as they call it, back then. And the people would not cheer. You know, they'd sit there out of respect, and they'd be very quiet during your match. It was weird to do, like wrestling in a place that had no people. I mean, it could be full of people, but if you're having a good match, they would, out of respect, would sit there. Now, they've changed since then. They've become more, I guess, Americanized or even Europeanized as far as how they respond with the posters and all the stuff they do now. But back then, it was completely different. But I really enjoyed Japan.
Yeah, well, and kind of circling back to your career in the United States, how do you get picked up by the WWF when you're working in Texas and, like you said, you're at the Sportatorium for some of your first stuff, you're in Japan? How does that call happen? Does Vince call you directly?
No, I got very lucky. My whole career got really lucky. Larry Cameron had passed away. He was a wrestler that passed away working for the Otto Vance territory up during a match with Tony St. Clair in Bremen. And I'm not sure what all was going on, but none of the Americans came back the next year. They got a whole new American crew, and Otto had this great territory over there. So literally, because of the Japanese connection, Jimmy Suzuki is sitting in, the reporter, is a good friend of mine, was sitting in the office with Otto, and he's looking for one more person, and my picture's there, and he goes, oh, I know John, he's a good boy. And Otto goes, okay, I take him. And that's how I got my best job next to WWE. And so I'm there for 2 years because of that, all because Jimmy just happened to be sitting there, and I got lucky. And so in 94, I guess it was, I go to Europe for the first time, and I was there basically 2 years, two seasons, not two full years because it was kind of broken up, but two seasons. We'd wrestle over there for like, you know, 56 straight days in Hanover, a couple months in Bremen. We'd spend the summer in Austria, and some terrific talent over there. You know, Finley, St. Clair, Schumann, Gustl, Smiesel, Ulf. I mean, there's Klaus Karoff. There's so many terrific wrestlers that would come over there. And I was over there 2 years, and literally, I don't remember who told me. We think it might have been Owen Hart, but they said, WWE wants to talk to you. And I'd been there for 2 years. So go downtown. There's a payphone down there. They're going to call you. And so it was raining this day. It was cold. It's in the winter. It's in December. And I just remember thinking, this is the dumbest thing I've ever done. I'm standing out there with an umbrella waiting for this payphone to ring in the middle of Germany. I went, this is, I'm trying to figure out where the people are that are, they're pulling the rib on me, because there's no way this is legit. And the damn thing rings, and I answer the phone, and it's Bruce Prichard. He's there with Pat Patterson. They said, hey, we've been looking at some of your stuff. We want you to come through when you're done with the tour and talk to us about signing with the company. And I said, well, WCW has shown some interest also. And they said, well, we want you to come through here first. And so that's what happened. I come through at the end of the tour, come through to Philadelphia, and didn't work that day, worked out the next day in Bethlehem, and had Savio Vega in the ring, who's an unbelievable, both human being and wrestler, had the right guy, and to come back and get hired. Jerry Briscoe pulled me aside and hired me on the spot.
Were you friends with Jerry Briscoe, like, from the get-go, or when did you guys kind of become closer friends after it was just kind of a higher-up employee situation?
Yeah, no, he's from Oklahoma, so I would not be his friend. No, I didn't know anybody. I came in. I literally didn't know anybody. And I wrestled the match. And back, Vince was doing commentary back then, so Vince didn't see it. And Jerry told me the story. He watched the match, and he went to Vince, and he goes, hey, we need to hire this kid. And Vince said, okay. And he said, why is the rush? He goes, well, he's going to WCW. And Vince said, well, if you need to hire him, hire him. And so Jerry had just seen the match. That was all. I don't even know if I'd been introduced to him before that. And I had the match with Savio. I thought it went really well. Dutch Mantel walked the ring with me because he had nothing else to do. And I come back and I said, what do you think? He goes, you got a job. He goes, there's no way you don't get a job. And, Savio was great. But nobody said anything to me. And so I just thought I'll shower and go. And so here comes JJ, Dylan, and Jerry. JJ was the head of talent at the time and followed me. They came in and said, hey, we want to sign you. And they said, you're going to WCW? I said, yeah. And they said, well, we don't want you to go. And I said, well, how do I know you're going to sign me? And they said, well, how do we know you're not going? So Jerry stuck his hand out. And I thought, you know what? There's something about this guy I trust. And I turned out to be right. You know, he's become one of my best lifelong friends and one of the true blessings of my life is being friends with Gerald Briscoe, and end up signing with him and then going up to headquarters the next month, meeting Vince and JJ and getting all the paperwork and stuff done.
Yeah, well, and you're in the WWF, you're one of the new Blackjacks. You're Blackjack Bradshaw. How does that come about? And were the original Blackjacks, Mulligan and Lanza, were they any sort of inspiration for you?
Yeah, a couple things. When I first started, I'm from Sweetwater, Texas, legitimately. That's where I grew up, and very proud of that. Love my people back there. Man, Mulligan always claimed he was from Sweetwater, Texas. To my knowledge, he never lived there. He and Barry lived somewhere just around Austin, I believe. And because of that, Gary Hart was doing commentary, and when he saw that I was from Sweetwater, he just made up the fact that I'm Barry Windham's cousin. Because we looked a little bit alike when we were younger, both younger. And, it really helped me, but I felt terrible about it because I didn't want to portray that I'm Barry Windham's cousin to get a job. I don't know Barry and I don't have his permission to do this, but so I've kept telling guys, don't say that. Please don't say that. So when I finally meet Barry, I'm like, looking at him thinking, do I have any heat? He had no idea. He hadn't paid attention to you. There wasn't the internet back there. And Barry's not a guy that cares anyway. So I met Barry when he came in. And I don't know. I remember why they stuck us together. Maybe just because we're both kind of the same height, same type character. But Lanza was an agent there and was a very dear friend of mine. So I went to Blackjack Lanza, and I said, hey, do you mind me being a Blackjack? And he said, nope, love for you to do it. He did the videos for us and stuff. I never got to meet Mulligan until years later.
So when you come in, you're with the Blackjacks. How did it transition into you coming up with Ron and the Acolytes and the APA? How did that transition come about?
Barry and I weren't used. I don't know why, and I thought we could have been, but anyway, it didn't work out. I loved being with Barry Windham. To this day, I just have a huge admiration for Barry, and he's a dear friend. And he still, at that time, could have but just whatever reason, it didn't work out. And I kind of hate that because Barry was, Barry hadn't got hurt. He'd have been NWA for champion forever. He was that good. I mean, Barry was just God's gift to wrestling and just a good dude. I enjoyed being around him. But when that didn't work out, me and Ron were just friends, and that was it. And they for some reason weren't doing much with Ron, which I mean, you have the first black heavyweight champion and you're not doing anything with him. I mean, that was a real failure on their part. But thank goodness for me, they decided to put us together just because we're friends. We both played football. Him at a higher level than me and with a lot more honors than me. But we kind of came from the same top background and we were already friends, and they just stuck us together to see what would happen.
Did you guys kind of have that reputation already as like you could kick ass if you needed to backstage, or did that come with the character later?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that. You know, Ron's the unfuckwithable guy. So the famous story with Arn Anderson and Butch Reed getting tied up by the Steiners. So
yeah,
Ron is a man's man.
Absolutely. I mean, Ron's one of your favorites of all time, right?
He is one of my favorites. I loved when he was WCW first black champion, you know, and I had the same thought. Why did they not do anything with him? He's such a great, not only character, but person. And I thought, man, I didn't understand why they didn't do anything with him. But like you said, thank goodness they for you, because the APA, and it became such a great tag team and a lot of fun to watch. And I will say, I'm going to give a little bit of a plug here. The other day, Undertaker released his podcast with you on it. And I don't think I've ever laughed so hard listening to you tell some stories. And you were telling this, one of the stories with you and Ron traveling, I think, with Teddy Long. And Teddy forgot him after in a snowstorm. And I haven't laughed so hard just listening to your stories. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I mean, I've watched, you know, I'm 43 years old, I think.
3 is what we decided, yeah.
And I've been a fan of yours a long time. I think I became an even bigger fan watching your podcast stuff with Jerry and with Undertaker and stuff, just seeing you behind the scenes. And you are so entertaining, so funny, and the way you tell the stories and everything, it tickles me. I mean, I was walking down the street with my headphones on the other night out for my walk, and if people saw me, they had to think this guy's on drugs or something, because I'm just laughing my rear end off walking down the street listening to your stories. So you can tell that you have a very good relationship with Ron and with Jerry. I mean, you give Jerry you give him a hard time. You can see that you guys have that relationship. Did that develop right away, or was that something that came over time? Because I loved the story of you talking about Jack and Danny Hodge, I think, found your pictures of what you did to the Oklahoma sign.
Yeah.
Did that relationship?
I knew Jerry had gotten me so many times. You know, Jerry's a tough dude and can wrestle, a really good wrestler. You know, so the difference between just being a tough guy and knowing how to wrestle. Jerry knew how to wrestle. He has stretched me so many times. So I was so happy with all those pictures. And for those that don't know, what I did was, me and Barry Windham went around, before you had all the cell phones, you went around and we took Polaroid pictures of me pissing on Briscoe's hometown sign. So like Blackwell and Stillwater, pissed on his working town and his legit town and the Oklahoma State sign. Every bit of it. And that, the story I told also, which I'll tell again, was when the Sheik passed by. That was the craziest thing ever. So Sheik thought my name was Brad Shaw, two names. So I'm sitting there and I'm pissing on like the Stillwater city limit side. Barry Windham is behind me taking the Polaroid, and I hear, "Mr. Shaw," and I look around and it's the Sheik. He's in a car. We're in the middle of nowhere, and the Sheik is just there. He just appeared. He's with Rikishi, and I said, "Yeah, Mr. Sheik." He goes, "Is everything okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm pissing on Briscoe's hometown." And he goes, "Ah, Brad, you're such a fine boy." And he drove off. Yeah, it was just something that's like an SNL skit that just comes out of nowhere. You're like, did that really just happen? I'm not sure. Was that really the Sheik? So then I put the pictures up in catering. I'm so proud of myself. And then when I saw Jack Briscoe and Danny Hodge walk in, I'm like, oh, my God, they are going to kill me. I mean, because I knew what Jerry would do to me. I didn't know what Jack would do to me or what Danny would do to me, because, you know, I didn't know them as well. And I, there I am pissing on everything in Oklahoma. You know, I got every landmark in Oklahoma. I got Polaroids of me on in Katery and me pissing on it. And there's a toilet bowl, and I put Briscoe Family Reunion above that. I took a picture of that too. Oh, my God. Danny got hold of me. I thought he broke my arm. I couldn't work out for about 2 or 3 months. And he's like, he's got my arm. He's got that grip, you know, where he could, you know, he could break pliers. He could take a steel belted radial and squeeze it like this. I mean, it's just legendary strength. I felt it. And he's got my arm. And he's just, I thought he's breaking it. And he's like, do you think you're funny? No, I don't. No, I want to apologize really badly to you right now. Will you please accept it? Yeah.
Oh, God, I love the stories. And you're not kidding with Danny Hodge and his grip, because we met him. My kids were wrestling, I think it was about 10 years ago, and he was still crushing apples with just his grip. It's just,
oh, he was just legendary. I don't know how that's possible, you know, what he used to do. You know, he's an undefeated boxer, undefeated wrestler. I mean, that guy was one of the greatest athletes of the last century.
Absolutely.
I signed Briscoe up for a retirement home in Texas one time, and oh my God, they kept calling and going, your uncle is cussing at us really bad every time we call him. So I'd hear Jerry talk about it. He goes, every time I get back to the body shop after a weekend, he said, I got this stupid retirement home in Texas that thinks I'm coming there. And he hadn't figured out it yet. It was me. And finally, I tell Ron one day, I go, man, I said, he won't sell it to me. And Ron goes, what happened? I go, I signed him up for a retirement home. Ron goes, oh, my God. He goes, that's great. Jerry was hiding around. He'd been hiding around the door, waiting, just listening to me and Ron talk, hoping I'd stooge myself. And I did.
Oh, that's great. I love the stories. I love them.
He signed me up recently from some stupid Oklahoma newsletter or something. I get it on my phone every morning. You know, it's like they got like a new meth lab or something that's opened up or something. Yeah. Somebody learned how to read or something. I don't know.
The big news.
See, here's what I think about politics, and I don't mean to get political, but Trump's right about the wall. He's wrong about the location. We need it around Oklahoma.
Completely close it off.
Keep all those hillbillies out of the rest of the country.
As we like Mr. Briscoe, we won't comment on the matter. But
died in Iowa a couple of years ago. You know, there at the bar.
He died in Iowa.
Yeah. He had a heart. Well, he thought he had a heart attack, but he didn't. We're sitting there at the bar, and he's about to have a drink of a Gable beer, by the way. I hope this is a good endorsement, not a bad endorsement. And he looks at me, goes, call 911. I'm having a stroke. And I said, huh? And as soon as I did, he fell off his chair. I mean, he was covered in sweat, and Tony Gurria's wife had caught him before he fell. And I thought, oh, my God, I literally thought we had lost him. I thought he had died. And so I turned to James Beard and I said, call 911. He kind of started laughing. Then he saw that Jerry had something had happened. And James calls 911 and the ambulance was there. I mean, unbelievably fast. So we get him on the gurney, people all in the bar, and we're taking him out. He spends a couple days in the hospital. Turns out he didn't have a heart attack. He had some type of dehydration issue, but he wasn't, you know, trouble. And he had stroke before. He's worried he's having another one. So as they're taking him out, I tell him, because there was this rivalry between Oklahoma and Iowa. As they're taking him out, I said, now, Mr. Briscoe, don't you die in Iowa. You know how embarrassing that would be? And he has not said a word. His eyes have been closed. And from a dead sleep, from a dead pass out, he's like Undertaker. He looks up, he goes, no shit. And that's when he kicked out. And the guys with the gurney are like, what does that mean? I go, dude, I just revived him. You should thank me.
Yeah. Hopefully the paramedics bought you another round. As you were in the APA, that kind of goes away and you guys start to work individually, but you did reunite in 2003, I think. And we get some really fun segments, including the bar brawl match at Vengeance, I think it is. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm just really interested because that's one of the silliest, most fun things that I remember, and I loved to watch it growing up.
That was so fun. You know, Funaki did a great job in that match. There were so many guys in it. I think the Easter Bunny threw a window or something. And we had so much fun with those bar brawls. They were just a blast. You know, we would tear stuff up, and it was insane. You know, we had no OSHA standards or nothing. We just okay, I'm going to throw you through that wall. And we were hoping that there wasn't anything on the other side. And it was, I remember one time I grabbed Bull Buchanan and we had a wall I was going to throw him through. And you got to do it live because everything gets busted up and you can't do a second take. And so I grabbed Bull and I'm going to throw him through a wall and I'm going to go through with him. And when I do, he goes, wrong wall. And I said, I'm sorry, Bull. And we both fell through this wall. We had no idea. We landed right inside a bathroom, like right by the toilet and all this stuff, and just missed everything.
That's so much fun. I actually also want to mention, I didn't have this in my notes earlier, but as of the day we're recording this, this is 316 day, and you did actually get to share the ring with Steve Austin a few times. You tag-teamed with him in some of his last matches of his career. Tell us a little bit about working with Steve Austin.
I've never been around. Steve's a terrific dude, first of all. He's a great guy. I want to say that first and foremost. I've never seen anybody get hot like Steve, ever. I wasn't there for Hogan. Obviously wasn't there for Jim Londos, years before that. But I've never seen anything like it. We couldn't sell tickets. When I got there in 95, we had all these great talent. But they're all in different characters. Glenn Big Kane was a dentist. Hunter was an aristocrat. The New Age Outlaws were a hillbilly and a roadie. We had great talent. Steve was the ringmaster. But the guys were just in gimmicks that hadn't worked. And then all of a sudden, Steve gets hot on 316. And I've never seen anything like it. Any building in the world, I mean, literally anywhere in the world, you put his name on, that building sold out. I've never seen anything like that. And it started happening right away. Steve was always a really good worker, but he just clicked. And when it did, man, that guy would come out. The ovations I'd see every night. And you couldn't get Steve to go under 30 minutes, no matter what he did. You go, Steve, don't go too long tonight. Steve would go 30, 45 minutes, then drink beers for another 15, 20 minutes. I mean, Steve just loved performing. And that night that happened, you just felt like you caught lightning in a bottle. And then all of a sudden, Bennis just took off, and it was incredible. Yeah. And by the way, I'm the one responsible for Steve making it 100%. You see, I wrestled Jake Roberts in the quarterfinals of the King of the Ring. And, Jake had that religious gimmick. That's why Steve did the Austin 316. If I had beat Jake, Austin 316 would have never happened.
True.
So pretty much I am solely responsible for Steve Austin, Austin 316, and the Attitude Era.
You have to take that credit where you can. You
gotta exactly. Take that. And I think it's justifiable.
Do you get royalties on the Austin 316 shirts like you
should? I should. I don't think I've ever gotten anything. I've never even been in one of Rock's movies, never even gotten a free ticket. So, no.
You're missing
out. Somehow they missed me on that. I'm sure it's in the mail.
Yeah, I'm sure. You got to go check on that. Another thing I want to ask you about, again, something just popped into my head. You've been asked a lot, I'm sure, about the Brawl for All. And I don't really want to focus too much on the specifics of it, but I am curious, do you think there's any way that something like the Brawl for All could ever work in pro wrestling?
No. No, I mean, the thing was, it was never going to work. First of all, they called me on a Thursday, Bruce Pritchard did, and they said, we're going to have a shoot tournament. And I said, why? We've got two UFC champions on our roster. Shamrock and Severn were there. I go, guys, just have them fight. That's who's going to be your winner. It's pretty simple. These guys have already done this before. And he said, we're going to do this. I said, and I told him also, by the way, I said, hey, you're going to put me out there against Henry Godwin. I said, I know you are. They want to see the two big cowboys hit each other in the face a bunch of times. And he goes, no. It's a legit shoot. We're not working any of it. I get there on Monday. It's me against Henry Godwin. Just exactly like I called it. The problem is, it's like Dr. Death. Dr. Death was a badass, and that a lot of the tournament was put together. And I told Bruce, I said, Doc's not going to win this. He's not the same Doc that was there 10 years ago. He's had concussions. He's had a million injuries. We're older. We're not 24. Guys are approaching 40. A lot of injuries, and so I don't think there's any way to make it work. And I'm not sure people want to see it work. Say you have whoever wins. Say Bart Gunn, incredible tough guy. Legit tough guy and a wonderful person. But why didn't Stone Cold enter it? Why didn't Rock enter it? It's hard to say, okay, guys, this part's a shoot, this part's a work. So I just don't think the thing was very well founded. Yeah, and I don't think that's why I don't think it could work today, because what do you do with it? you have, you know, some shooter that comes in and you don't put some of your top guys in, which we weren't going to do then because of injuries. So we had, injuries were just astronomical for how many guys got hurt because we're older. We're not young guys anymore.
Well, and if you're going to do something along that shoot style, just a quick shout out for the Hall of Fame winning the George Tragos Award this year is Josh Barnett and his blood sport. I mean, that's a very interesting concept and very well executed. So I think that's probably as close as you can get to showcasing that side of things without, you know, venturing into the territory of real injury.
Yeah, and a couple things. I love what Josh does with his blood sport. I think it's fantastic. I enjoy the style he does. Very similar to the UWFI back in Japan back in the day. That was, you know, a mix between kind of a really, you know, kind of almost a shoot and with some work aspects to it. And, you know, people enjoy that. And I think something like that can work. And obviously it works with Josh. He's a terrific talent, very tough guy, but also very charismatic, and people want to see him wrestle. I just think it's going to be tough to put a tournament together for something like that.
Absolutely. And you are personally, always have been, a favorite wrestler of mine. I remember defending you in school because you, when I was born, you were the WWE champion. If that gives you any timeline on where we're at. I would go back, and I had all these old DVDs and everything I would watch, and some other wrestling friends of mine, they'd say, JBL, you know, he's just such a mean, nasty, you know, so-and-so. And I'd say, no, you don't understand. He's right. He's right about everything he's saying. He deserves to be the champion. And I'll be honest, watching WrestleMania 21 back, while John Cena became one of my favorites, I was kind of upset to see you lose the title. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. The wrong guy won that night.
But during that time in 2004, Judgment Day, my favorite match of yours by far with Eddie Guerrero. Boy, is that a bloody match! And it begs the question to me, you probably didn't know going into it how, in my eyes, how great that match was going to be. Do you look back on that as one of your favorite matches that you've ever had?
I do, because that was just us. And I love being out there in the ring with Eddie. There was nothing, I tell people all the time, you know, there are certain guys in the history of this business that you have to experience live to understand. And you can't explain a guy like Eddie, can't explain a guy like Shawn Michaels, can't explain a guy like Kurt Angle. I mean, you can't explain it until you see these guys. It's like an electric cord that's not grounded, and that thing gets stuck out in the arena, and the place just changes when those guys come out. And we were there talking over the match, and Pat Patterson was trying to help. We'd had some pretty good matches on the loop leading up to it, and I could tell that Eddie didn't like something, and so when Pat left the room, I said, Eddie, what do you not like? He said, none of it. I said, you don't like any of it? And he said, no. And he said, I don't feel it. Eddie was feel, 100% feel. And so I went to Pat, who's a good friend of mine, and I said, Pat, I said, we got a problem. And I said, Eddie does not like the match. And he said, which part of it? I said, none of it. And Pat was great. He said, guys, if you make or you don't make it, it's going to be based upon what you do. And if you don't think like what I have for you, I was just trying to help. He said, then you should do what you think's best. We went out there without anything at all pre-planned, including the finish. Now, we knew we were doing a DQ. We were doing it about a certain time. But we had zero that we planned backstage. And that's one of the reasons I liked that match so much, because it was just feel. I mean, it was 100% feel between me and Eddie going out there. And, you know, thank God we had so much heat for us. And the place was about 99% Latino. So it was a perfect setting for me to be a heel in. And, we just knew it would work. And fortunately, it did.
Well, you talk about with working with Eddie and you being able to be heel. I've heard in other podcasts talking with you, you drew quite a bit of heat with the Guerrero family. And I mean, they knew back, you know, they were wise to it. But, you know, with a lot of the population, you got run out of town. If I remember hearing you, your story, they didn't even want you back in town. You had so much heat.
Yeah, I got a police escort. I got a police escort all the way to the city limit of El Paso. They literally took me to the edge of the city limit and said, do not come back. We think you'll be killed. And literally they did. And a year or two later, they had a show in El Paso. and they wouldn't book me there. They thought something would happen to me. I mean, Vince told me several times that if I can keep you alive, he said, we're going to do real well with this. You know, we needed something. And that's when the heart attack angle came with Eddie's mother. It was a Mother's Day weekend in El Paso. They're honoring Gory Guerrero, Eddie's dad, who is a legendary wrestler, terrific wrestler. And, you know, it's kind of like honoring Fritz in Dallas or Stu up in Calgary. You know, it was a really big deal for the city. And people were chanting, Gory, Gory, Gory. And, you know, Chavo Guerrero had, I believe it's Chavo, I'm not sure, he's the one that pitched it to me, Eddie's brother, not his nephew, gave me the storyline of, I'm going to come back down and jump Eddie, and his mother's going to have a heart attack, and they're going to cart her off in an ambulance. And so that's what we did. And when I came out, back out, hit Eddie, he goes down, grabbed the mother. I don't grab her, but what I do is when I put my hand on her shoulder, it looks like I'm manhandling her. What I'm doing is I'm allowing her to take a bump. So I've got my hand on her shoulder, but she's holding on to me is what it is. And so it looks like I'm forcing, like I'm taking her down. That's Miss Guerrero. And Eddie's got a lot of brothers. I'm making sure Miss Guerrero is perfectly fine. Plus, she was a terrifically sweet lady. And I take her down, and I've never in my life felt anything like that. I've been in a couple riots. I've had somebody try to stab me, you know, because of heat. And I've been in a lot of stuff with fans. I've never seen it like this. That entire place, which was basically 100% Latino, went silent. I mean, completely silent. They could not believe what I had just done. And Eddie's on the ground. And he goes, S.A., you better get the fuck out of here. But I got to get it filmed. You know, Eddie's giving me this gift. I'm not going to leave until we got this thing filmed. And so we have state troopers around the ring. We have cops around the ring. We have everybody around the ring. They're there to protect me because they know how bad this is going to be. And they're screaming at me, John, get out of the arena, get out of the arena. But I got to get it on camera. And there's no reason to do it if you don't. And so when I finally got to the back, I mean, that place was just about to riot. You could feel it. I mean, you could feel how dangerous it was. And I get in my car and I drive straight out to the interstate. The police take me out there. I mean, the police get on both sides of me and take me straight out of the city. And I pull off. We got there so quick. I pull off right when we get past the city limit sign. And I said, guys, nobody followed us. I said, thank you very much. They go, look, do not come back. Drive all the way to Odessa. That you're going to fly out of there. WWE had already arranged me to have a room there and a flight out of Odessa. And they said, but do not come back. We think you'll be killed. And so I ended up driving to Odessa. When that thing aired, everything changed. I mean, we had first night it aired, San Bernardino. We have a jumper in the ring, and thank God Little Hebner turned into Pat McAfee and basically kicked the guy's head off, you know, saved me. And I think it's a funny story because, you know, back then they used to beat these guys up, and they beat them up bad. Security would, you know, they take them back. They enjoy you. They'd beat these guys up. So they got this guy who's trying to get to me. They got him in the back, and they're beating him up. So I get on the microphone. There's no security. I get on the microphone. I said, listen, there ain't no security. And I got this line from Dutch Mantel. Always use like 2 or 3 minutes, you know, something for something astronomical. But I'll explain in a minute. I said, any of you other Mexicans want to jump over that rail, I'll whoop this whole arena if it takes me 5 minutes. Which, of course, is preposterous. And Little Hebner looks at me. He's in the ring. And I tell Little Hebner, I said, you watch my back, I'll watch yours. He goes, we're the only white guys in here. He goes, shut the fuck up. We're going to die. And security hears me, and they come running back. I mean, they're like just sprinting back like, he's done it again. Get somebody to save his stupid ass. Oh, yeah. But that was nightly. I mean, it was crazy that time. I had so much heat. I'd walk through the airport, and you'd see a group of Hispanics, Latinos sitting over somewhere, and you could hear them cussing me. I mean, just as soon as I walked there, wherever I go, I go out with my wife in New York, and you see a group of, same thing, Latinos. They're like, cabrón. You can hear them just cussing me as I walk by. Just like, what's all that? Like, oh, nothing. They're talking about somebody else.
Testament to your ability to get heat and how well you worked with Eddie and his family. That's honestly one of my favorite eras watching you. It's just, it's so good. I loved your work and I loved Eddie and that.
Around that time, though, the heat starts to tamper down a year or two after that. You transition to commentary. Well, and I shouldn't say the heat tampers down because you're not a straight commentator. You're still working heel in the booth. I wanted to ask you, how does that transition to commentary happen in 2006, 2007? And did Michael Cole help with that at all? We hear that he helps with a lot of that stuff.
Michael Cole's awesome. I think Michael Cole is the greatest of all time of commentators. And no offense to my dear friend Jim Ross and Gordon Soley and Lance down in Memphis. But I worked with Michael, and you know, that's where my bias lies. Michael was awesome to work with. He's just an absolute professional. He's great at what he does. And I got out there, and it was so much fun. I remember the first time I did commentary, it was during the Attitude Era. And I go out there, and JR had all these copious notes, you know, which like a lot of play-by-play guys did. JR is one of the all-time greats. And King is sitting there next to him, Jerry Lawler, and he's drawing a woman in the front row. That's the only note he has. And I thought, that's how you do commentary. And it really is. You know, those guys tell Shaq and Charles and Kenny, just show up. We'll lay the table for you, and you guys just react. And that's, to me, how a color commentator, you should do some research. But it's up to the play-by-play guy to set the table. And Michael Cole was so good about that. I just thought my career was done. I didn't think about doing commentary. And I got a call one afternoon from Kevin Dunn, and he goes, hey, we're thinking about putting you in commentary. What would you think? It had never occurred to me. I mean, it really hadn't. I never thought that was something I would do. But as soon as he said it, I thought that could be a lot of fun. And so right away I went in, and I had a blast with it.
And you've done commentary now all the way up to Saturday night. You were on with AAA.
Yep, I'm doing commentary now with AAA, which I'm having so much fun with. That is such a – you know, I'm biased, obviously, because I'm doing the commentary there. Nothing because of me. I'm working with Corey Graves and Rey Mysterio. Conan, you know, is out right now with some health issues. Hopefully, he's back soon. And but shout out to our friend Conan. But I just think it's the best show in television right now. I mean, now I understand it's easier when you're doing an hour as compared to, say, you know, the 8 or 10 hours WWE has to do. But it's just so much fun. And it's so refreshing. It's new characters. It's a different style. It's the Lucha Libre style. And I'm having a lot of fun with AAA. And by the way, Jeremy Borash and Undertaker, I mean, they are just brilliant guys. I've been blown away because I've been sitting through the creative meetings with them, and I've sat through a lot of creative meetings in my life with Vince and with, you know, Fritz and you name it, some really incredible, smart people. Those guys are doing a wonderful job there.
And you talk about sitting in the meetings with them and stuff. Undertaker's not one that I – would imagine being a booker for AAA. It just the transition for that just doesn't roll off the tongue for me. So
hats, you know, off to him. We had one day we had some of the little guys, some of the minis, and then we had intergender match. Then we had Pimpy there, you know, who's an exotica as they refer to, and Undertaker's doing all this stuff. And I said, I'm glad you're keeping it old school. But he does a great job with it. You know, he's a really smart guy, and anybody who's been a character that long obviously has to be a really smart guy. And Undertaker sits there, I watch him, he runs the show along with Jeremy Borash, and they have some great people around him, and they do an incredible job. I'm blown away by how well they have things done.
Well, and some other things that you had been doing recently, a few months ago we saw you kind of chasing Nick Nemeth around the world, clotheslining him. Seemingly he couldn't get away from you. And
now I wasn't clotheslining Nick. I was helping Nick.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I did punch his brother a few times, which I really enjoyed.
I believe that. That's right. You were helping Nick. And now we see that he's going into the Hall of Fame this year as the inductee. I just wonder, are you helping him in all these matches and everything to get him to that Hall of Fame status? Maybe you're trying to get an angle for yourself in at some point. I don't know. Maybe there's another JBL title run coming in some promotion. Who knows?
You never know, but probably not. But when Nick doesn't need any help in the Hall of Fame, I got to call so many of Nick's matches. I've always called him Dolph. It's so strange for me to call him by his real name. But I've called so many of Nick's matches that he doesn't have a bad match. I mean, he's one of the best wrestlers in the world, and he has been for years. He's just fantastic. And I've been out there. You know, I got to work with Baron Corbin a little while, and I got to be at, you know, inside the bowl and working at a little bit different level when I'm out there with him. And seeing him up close, Nick, I'm just blown away by how good he is. You know, he's a great athlete, but he's also a guy who really understands the business, and he's just done a fantastic job.
Yeah, well, and a couple of the other people that were being honored at the Hall of Fame this year, you've already mentioned James Beard getting the Impact Award. That's not a name that wrestling fans hear a lot in a lot of these stories. Can you tell us a little bit about why James Beard is so important?
Yeah, he was a big part of Texas wrestling, has been for decades. And James is one of these referees, kind of like Nick Patrick. Very few of these guys, I don't know about very few, well, very few, you know, could actually call matches from the referee position. You know, that's a real different level. James could do that, and or can do that because he still referees. But James has been a booker. He's been a referee. He's been both for many years. I rode with James and Skandor Akbar and Killer Tim Brooks when I first started. And James really helped me in my career. And I'm really happy that he's going in, but very well deserved. I mean, Texas wrestling would be a lot different if James Beard had not been involved.
Absolutely. Well, and some other people that kind of formed the foundation of what wrestling is today, getting the Frank Gotch Award, Jeff Jarrett. Do you have any quick thoughts on Jeff Jarrett?
Oh, I can't tell you how much I love Jeff Jarrett. He is such a good person and a great worker, but he's just a good dude. You know, I got to work with Jeff back in the 90s. I really enjoyed it. I'm friends with Jeff now, and I'm very thankful for that. He's a really smart guy. You know, he's a hustler, and I mean that in a very good way. You know, he's always working. He's always got, you know, things that he's working on here and there. He's one of these guys that can work on a million different things at once. But Jeff is one of these guys that has been so integral as part of this business. That story about him holding up Vince, as they said, which wasn't quite exactly what happened at the pay-per-view, just a brilliant story. I mean, nobody got away with that. Nobody's able to get away with holding up Vince except for Jeff Jarrett. The only thing I'm mad at Jeff Jarrett, Stan Hansen always called himself the Last Cowboy, and so I was good friends with Stan, so I always figured I would get that name, you know, when Stan retired, and that damn Jeff Jarrett stole it before I did.
Well, and so much going on with this Hall of Fame weekend coming up. That's July 9th through 11th in Waterloo, Iowa. You're going to be there, and something a little bit different happening this year. The softball game, you and Medusa against each other, both captaining teams. Are you excited for this softball game, July 11th?
I'm going to beat the hell out of Medusa. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm not bringing this bat, but I do have my Louisville JBL bat that they actually made for me at the Louisville Slugger Museum. I'm a huge baseball fan. Love the World Baseball Classic that just happened. Wish it hadn't ended on a ball that was called a strike, even though our guys won. I was happy for that. But I'm excited about this. We're going to have a lot of fun. Medusa's a great lady. She's a great person, and she's a terrific character also. So it's going to be a lot of fun, my team against Medusa's team. And we're going to have a bunch of legends out there. It's July 11th. What's the name of the park again?
Riverfront Stadium.
Riverfront Stadium. I'm not sure exactly the time. It's going to be on a Saturday morning. We're going to have a lot of fun out there. We're going to have a lot of different stuff going on. You guys, thankfully, at the Wave have got up and stood up and, you know, huge support with us, which we greatly appreciate. All you guys are doing a real part of the fabric there of Iowa. You guys are at the Wave. And we're going to have a lot of stuff going on. We got some Cassio Kid. It looks like the great comedian is going to be there to do some stuff. And we're going to have a lot of fun. And hopefully, I think we're also going to have a home run tournament. So there's going to be a home run king crowned.
A lot of fun, a lot of excitement coming up on that weekend. And yeah, just some other things. Obviously, the Hall of Fame banquet is that weekend. There's going to be a pro wrestling show that happens that weekend. But I think you're hosting what might be the takeaway of the entire weekend at the end, Beers with the Boys. Tell us a little bit, why should people get tickets to Beers with the Boys? How fun is this going to be?
This is going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be something that we're not going to record. It's just going to be something that guys are going to sit around and just tell some of the wildest, crazy stories you've ever heard about some of the greatest legends of all time. You know, we're not going to bury anybody, but we're going to bury except ourselves. Statute of limitations has run out, so you still can't be indicted for something you did, I think, 30 or 40 years ago. So it's just fun. It's just going to be, have a couple guys sitting around, got a little format, and we're going to have beers with the boys, and it should be an awesome event.
Well, we're really looking forward to it. We're looking forward to covering it, obviously. And the audio coverage of that going to be available on 99 The Wave. Here on the Radio On The Go YouTube channel, we're going to have a live broadcast of the softball game. And we're going to be popping in for all sorts of events over the course of that weekend. Colt, I think I heard that you are going to be a part of the softball game. We talked to Medusa last week. She wanted to know what team you were going to be on. You were undecided. Have you made a decision yet?
I have a personal preference if I'm gonna choose one. I also said I'm available for either team because I'm just happy to be there. But if I'm going to make my personal decision, it's going to be, I'm going to be sticking to JBL like glue because I can't, I love the stories. I have become a even bigger fan, listening to your podcast, being able to talk to you today. I'm going to fanboy just a little bit and kind of, I'll be by your side quite a bit, I think, there, John.
Well, thank you. You know, we're going to film something. We come up there. It's called Curtain Jerkers. We're debuting it actually today on Austin 316 Day. And I'm claiming it's Bradshaw 316 because I just stole Bruce's podcast. It's my new Bradshaw 316. I just stole your podcast. But we're going to look at Curtain Jerkers, which is a fun show. Impossible to explain, but we hope to film one of those episodes there as well. So come be on our team, and we're going to do everything we can to bash and humiliate Medusa.
Well, boy, oh boy, are we looking forward to it. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, you're going to enjoy Beers with the Boys in the entire weekend. Be sure to come to Waterloo, book a hotel, come to all of the events, and get the all-access pass and a lifetime membership to the George Tragos Luthez Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame in Waterloo. John, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate having you on. And, it's just been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Colt, it's been a pleasure to meet you.